Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, a podcast that aims to address divorce, separation and co-parenting here in the UK, countering the often sensationalist way it's portrayed in the media, challenging the status quo and driving for reform. On each episode, I'm joined by experts to discuss divorce, separation and co-parenting from different angles and to give their opinions and to debate them. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor and divorce coach, co-founder of Amicable, the divorce services company, and host of this, the Divorce Podcast. In this episode, I was joined by Louise Oliver, who's worked in the financial services sector for over 30 years and is a certified financial planner and chartered wealth manager. Louise is regularly featured as a financial expert in the media, including BBC Breakfast TV, BBC Radio 4, and Moneybox. In this longer episode, all about finances and divorce, we started by discussing how a financial planner can help during a divorce. We talked about the importance of each person really understanding their current financial situation at the outset of the process, and how that knowledge can enable them to make better informed decisions about any proposed settlement. Louise talked about the work a planner does to stress test potential settlements and looking at what's needed to ensure money lasts a lifetime rather than just the near future. Other topics we covered were business valuations and ensuring you consider life insurance if maintenance payments are being paid. But it was her message about making sure that you future-proof your settlements that really struck me as important and something that's often overlooked in the rush for a solution in divorce negotiations. Louise also touched on financial abuse, and whilst I'll dedicate a whole podcast to this subject later on, it was really good to hear about some of the less well-known red flags to watch out for. This episode is packed with financial tips for divorcing couples, so please enjoy. If you really loved this episode or want to hear more episodes like this, then please make sure to rate us on your preferred listening platform. Enjoy the episode. Welcome, Louise.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure.
It's absolutely lovely to see you. Thank you very much for joining us. You have a very interesting job when it comes to divorce, don't you? Tell me a little bit about how financial planners work when people are getting divorced.
Right, Kate. Well, we are privileged because we work with lots of families. And in any given family, there's often a divorce. Now, you know, the rates are getting on to one in two couples divorce during their lifetime. So the odds are on that we're going to come across it. And we sit in a very privileged position that we're able to help people plan through those changes. So what do we do? As financial planners, people come to us because they are fearful. There's a catalyst. There's a change happening in their lives. And divorce is one of those, as we know, really big, scary changes that people have to navigate through. And what we do is we try to take away the fear as much as we can by planning ahead. People worry, yes, about what's going to happen now, but also they worry about the future. Are they going to be able to afford their current lifestyle? Will they have to adapt? What about children's education, university fees? What about retirement provision, thinking a long way into the future? And all of this can become a real mishmash and a headache. So as a financial planner, we're able to look at all of the individual components that make up somebody's wealth, whether that's property or investments or pensions, life assurance products, healthcare products, all of those, critique them, but also look at the current situation and what the future holds. And what that actually does, Kate, is it promotes informed decisions for the individuals and the couples.
Because I guess that's the key, isn't it? It's that level of understanding and informing. Because I think for some people, a divorce might be the first time maybe they've ever got involved in the finances of the family. Perhaps their partner has done it in the past. So actually coming to a financial planner might be the first sort of foray into understanding what your wealth, your family wealth looks like. Do you come across that very often, Louise?
We do often. And when we work with couples, ordinarily, even when they're not going through a divorce and you hope that they never do, it's important to us that we work with them as a pair. So even if, and often it happens, one of the parties says, do you know, I'm not interested in the money. My husband or my wife, they always deal with that. I leave them to it. We really discourage that, because if there is a divorce or a bereavement or a situation where the individual who doesn't have the handle on the finances has to make those decisions, then they would be basically in a mess. So part of the coaching that we do as financial planners, when couples are going through divorces, sometimes often we're only working with, of course, one party to the divorce. The whole education piece comes in, so that working with a financial planner, the individual or the couple then have a position of strength. So they have a good understanding of their starting point and what might take the train off the tracks once they have a look at planning ahead. So you're quite right, Kate. It happens all the time. I have to say that it is often the female party of a couple who is the one that tends not to be interested in the finances. Not always, and it is changing, but that often is the situation, and people put themselves in a weaker position by not having a handle on their finances.
So it sounds to me like you can help right from the very beginning of the divorce, because obviously one of the first things we do as divorce coaches when somebody is going through this is we get them to do what's called a full financial disclosure. So getting together a list of all of the assets, debts, pensions, and income. So if you've never done any of this or not being sort of part of the family finances before, I guess that can be quite daunting as a task in itself, because you don't know what you don't know. So is it the case that as a financial planner, you can help people prepare for financial disclosure, for example?
Yes, Kate, we can. And it's really important. And many people really don't like talking about money.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you that. Why is it as women that we don't? Why do we sort of abdicate this responsibility? And again, I know we're talking in general terms, but you're right. When we see people, it is often the woman who hasn't got the handle on the finance. And I just, what is it culturally or societally that we're doing that allows this to happen?
I think that people have their head in the sand and they just get on with it and they don't want to worry about it. But what we find is initially it's quite scary and people are shocked about what their outgoings are. And we often send people back to do their homework again, because they might just roughly work out their outgoings. And we look at it, and the team here at Piercefield Oliver, and they'll say they haven't put anything down for, you know, food, or they haven't put anything down for insurances. So we here, we know what ordinary outgoings look like, and we know to watch for the items that they've missed. And we do challenge people to go back, and we ask them to do a couple of things, really. They do their essential expenditure, you know, what makes the family household tick. And then they do a discretionary expenditure. And these are items which, you know, they would like to have, but if they had to go, then there's a list. So you get two separate lists, and then the nice to have as well, the big holidays or whatever, changing the car. So it's sort of three different components. And people say that actually, although they're initially fearful, they really feel empowered once they've done it, because then they know their numbers. And as you know, Kate, if people know their numbers by the time they get to you, it makes your life and your job a whole lot easier.
Absolutely. There's nothing worse than people coming with unrealistic expectations or no clue about what they're actually spending. That's really challenging, because then when you're asking them to put together a budget of what they're going to need in the future, so you can see whether or not their income's going to be sufficient and how you might redistribute income to make it so, if you don't know what you're spending, that's an impossible task. And sometimes if people are looking at it, yeah, and if people are looking at it for the first time, it can be quite a shock, as you say. So having to deal with that and everything else that you're doing with the divorce just sort of stacks up problems. So I like the idea of the three lists. I think that's a really useful tip for people. Your absolute essentials, so things like your council tax, your mortgage, the stuff you can't avoid, the kind of nice to haves, and then the luxuries. And that, I think that's a really good way of looking at it, isn't it? Just so.
Yeah. And we can play with that, Kate.
Yeah.
And we can show different scenarios. We can run the essential expenditure, and then we can run the desirable. And if you're negotiating a divorce settlement, then you can maybe meet somewhere in the middle. Or if there's not enough, you know, to achieve the desirables, people have to bite the bullet and realize that it's going to be essential just for now. And then what really, really helps, even before people get to see a financial planner, if you can actually fish out your statements, your pension statements, your life policies, your ISAs, whatever you've got, and gain some up-to-date valuations, because you will need it, we will need it. And if couples can just take a little bit of time, pick up the phone, write to the providers, get a valuation, and it will save them time, you time, us time, and it will save them in fees if they can just put a little bit of work in before they employ, you know, professional services. It really does help.
Yeah, getting your house in order. And it's like anything. It's like when you go to the tip or you clean your cupboards out, you feel so much better afterwards, don't you?
You do.
Just like tidy mind. So yeah, absolutely.
One of the things that's subjective, just talking about the first steps, is business valuations. And I know that you come across this all the time, but if you run a business, again, it's very difficult, depending on the sector, to gain a true valuation of that business. And of course, if you are a shareholder in a business, so you're not the only sole shareholder, then the implications are much more complicated as far as how controlling you are in the company. And then you get into the realms of forensic valuations, which can be really complicated and very expensive. So I think if you are someone, and of course, more and more of us are running businesses now, so we do come across it. If you are someone who has a business, it might be worth just speaking to your accountant if you're thinking about going through a divorce, just to gain a handle on a rough idea as to how much your shareholding or your ownership in that business may well be worth. And it's different for divorce. It's different. You're not selling the business to a third party. So often the valuation may well be a little bit less than if you were just selling on the open market. So just to throw that in, it does throw a curveball sometimes when people are trying to negotiate a settlement.
Yeah, and it can have a very skewing effect, can't it? Because often, as you say, if you're not the only shareholder, you don't have a controlling stake. The business asset is illiquid, isn't it? So then that makes it even more complicated when you're trying to work out a settlement, because on paper, you can get what looks to be fair. But if one of you's sitting with a totally illiquid asset and nothing else, because the value of the business is such that that's what balances it out, then that again isn't necessarily something that's seen as fair as far as the court's concerned, is it? I mean, it's just tricky when it comes to business valuations.
And it's risky, Kate. It's a risky asset. Mm. And what I understand from courts is they don't like leaving one party with the risky asset.
Exactly.
It's not fair.
No.
Because it can be worth A one day and B the next, and depending on the sector. And especially when you look at hospitality and what we've been through over the last 2 years, for example, that sector could with regards to valuations, and travel.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, those business valuations, you might have been working on divorces, all of a sudden the business is worth so much less than it was when you started. So it's a moving target, really, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. So if people do have businesses, as you say, you can get a valuation from an accountant, and you mentioned forensic valuations. Tell us a little bit about that, because I know certainly when we work with couples, the idea of, let's just say for the sake of argument, it's the husband's business, the husband and the accountant sitting down together and coming up with a valuation may fill some people with absolute horror in terms of whether or not that's fair. So if that's not going to work for you, what are the other ways of getting a business valuation?
Well, if we're trying to be fair, which we always are, it's best to get an independent forensic valuer to value the business. And of course, if it goes anywhere near a court, they'll be looking at an independent expert to do that. Now, sectors are really important. Some people who value businesses will value one type of sector but not another. So it's very important to choose an expert that is particularly au fait with the sector that you're in. So for example, I'm in financial services. So if I was looking to do that, I'd look for a particular financial services expert. If you're in manufacturing, it's different. The multiples will be different to value the business. It's expensive. But how else do you get an understanding of what that component is valued at? And often it can be, you know, a large amount that might not come to fruition for that person for many years down the line. And also that business generates an income, and that income may support maintenance payments, spousal maintenance, child payments, university fees, school fees. So you don't want to sort of you know, mess around with the goose that lays the golden egg. So there's that sort of scenario as well. But it does make divorce a little bit more complicated if there is a business involved.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, one of the big questions we get is lots of people have limited companies because it's an effective or efficient way of paying themselves. That doesn't necessarily constitute a business when we're talking about a business in terms of divorce, does it? Just having a limited company, that you would potentially just count that as income, for example, if it's just a vehicle for paying yourself.
Yeah, you would. It depends what assets it has in it, Kate. Of course, some people have investment property portfolios wrapped inside a limited company, in which case there's a valuation of the assets there. It might just be something, you know, that derives an income from a small baseline. Yeah, you're right. It wouldn't always have a value. Some businesses don't, because they're all about the individual and you can't sell the person.
Mm, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So far, what you're saying is that the important thing is to do some prep. Don't bury your head in the sand. Confront that you need to understand the numbers and you need to understand what you've got. What are the common pitfalls that people fall into when planning their finances on divorce or separation? What do you sort of think people forget about or come a cropper with?
Yeah, people do forget to think about the future. They're in the moment. They're thinking, we need to get this sorted. Want to get as clean a break as possible. Most people do anyway. And they look at their numbers now. One of the biggest pitfalls is that people don't look into the future. They don't forecast forwards. And inflation, as we know, at the minute especially, can bite. So whatever you need now might be different in the future. So you have to, in my opinion, make an assumption for inflationary pressures as time goes on. You can use a long-term average. Any assumptions that you make have to be reasoned and reasonable. So looking at the long-term average of inflation, for example, is nearer to 3%. So you wouldn't necessarily forecast the 8-9%, maybe double digit figures we're heading for at the moment, sadly. So people forget to do that, to think about the longer term. They also forget to think about what might take the train off the track. To give you an example, if you're receiving a spousal maintenance or income for child benefit that's been awarded as a divorce, then you should look to insure the person that's paying the maintenance. Because if they're paying the maintenance from their income, which is very likely, and they die, or they're critically ill and they can't work, chances are the maintenance payment will fail. So to insure the risk of that happening is very important to consider. Now, there might be a policy that a couple already has.
Right.
In place, mm-hmm. that they could use and say, actually, at least you're covered for X or Y. We keep that in force because affordability is really key. Some people can't afford to take a new policy for this purpose. They also might be uninsurable if they've had health issues. I know a lot of the insurance companies, they're tightening their underwriting. We've just gone through 2 years of COVID. So we're getting more rated and declined cases currently. But it's worthwhile just thinking, okay, we've got the divorce settlement. What could go wrong here? And really stress test that situation and see how you can deal with that. Also, it might seem really obvious, but individual parties need to update their wills. They need to make sure that their will reflects their wishes. Once you're divorced, you need to start again, draw a line, and update your will. So it's important to do that. I think those are the main things that people do forget about. Also, planning for the future. What about family weddings? Who's going to pay? Half each? One of you? None of you? What about sort of one-off items? You know, what if something major breaks down in the family home? If one person's in that home, the boiler breaks, you know, who's going to pay for that? Is this some sort of an agreement that they, you know, both chip in for that? So those sort of things people forget to think about. So it's do your plan and then stress test it. And if it's acceptable and the downside is acceptable and you could cope with it, that's good. If you can make provision to avoid that being a problem, then do so.
And I guess one of the pitfalls that we come across as well is that people forget about some of the assets. So the most classic one for us is that people don't feel that pensions, for example, are marital assets. They feel they're personal assets. They belong to one person. So again, very typically, without wanting to sound like too stereotypical, it's often male partner has more pension than a female, and wife will say, I don't want any of the pension, I just want the house. And that's a really common scenario we get, where the focus, as you say quite rightly, is people are very obsessed with the here and now and not thinking about the future. But if you, as the wife who's taken the house and it's maybe on a measure, so it's divided fairly evenly once your children are grown, if you're suddenly left with no child maintenance, half a house and no pension because you wanted to stay in the house and that was your negotiation point, you're in a much worse position by that point, potentially not having been able to go back to your full career potential, than your husband will be, who's got a full pension, who's been able to continue to build career and so on and so forth. So it can, although it can look very even in the moment, it can look very lopsided by the time that scenario plays out. So what would you encourage women to do and to understand about pensions in order to be really thinking about this in a fair sense?
Yeah, it is looking at the long term. You're right. People do look at the situation now. So it's looking at, yes, the next 5 years, 10 years, but also those figures that you do for your expenditure. How much do you need to live? Throw those into the future, which that's what we do. That's what financial planners do. See how much income you need in retirement. And if you haven't got a pension, there's not going to be an income to pay your retirement at that stage. So it may be either be worth thinking about having a pension sharing order, or perhaps in that situation, that individual may just potentially be awarded a little bit more, if it's available, of the liquid assets to compensate for the fact that in retirement, they are literally not going to have the benefit that their divorcing spouse would have with the benefits of, you know, workplace pensions and all of that over the years. You know, some parties to divorce have far greater earnings potential than others. So if you've got a mum that's staying at home to look after the children, who's been awarded the house, and then the father still working, still climbing the career ladder, still getting pensions paid, then that disparity sometimes needs to be reflected in the divorce settlement. So there is provision for the longer term. And we have run financial plans for couples where we've looked at retirement provision and we've been able to go back and renegotiate for a little bit more in the way of liquid assets. So that individual can then start to invest in things like, even if it's not pensions, something like, you know, start saving to ISAs, something tax efficient for them for the future. So again, it's back to the planning piece, Kate.
So Louise, essentially what you're doing as the planner then is you're taking all of the here and now data and you're modelling what that data looks like in 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years' time to give people an understanding of how any potential settlement that might be on the table would pan out for them. Is that, have I got that right? Is that what you're doing?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, correct. And stress testing it at the same time.
Yeah, because exactly that. You're stress testing something that might feel like very fair and look very fair on paper right now, but it will show you how fair it is ultimately, won't it, by doing that kind of modelling. Yeah.
And it's as good as the information as you feed it.
Yeah.
It's just the same as, you know, the work that you're doing with your divorce coaches. If you're given the wrong information, the wrong outcome is going to happen. So this is why we critique, challenge people on, actually, is that going to be enough? How does that work? Not all plans are perfect, Kate. Most are not. Most people go into the red and they're going to run out of money. It's scary to see. So what then we say is, how can we deal with this? Do you always need a 5-bedroom house? What about when the kids leave home? Maybe we could build into the plan that the house is downsized in 10 years' time, release the equity, we invest the equity, let's say we get 4% a year on it as a cautious portfolio. How does that look? And then all of a sudden, it's looking a little bit more workable. But if you've managed somebody's expectations to say, actually, do you know, in 10 years' time, really you should downsize? When it gets to that stage, they've already accepted it and they know, and that's the plan, and they work towards it, and it isn't a shock, and they don't hit a brick wall and they don't panic. Okay, it's a family home and people are attached to it, but at the end of the day, it's a house. And it's far better that you have, you know, a good balance in your life and an income. So there are ways of, you know, looking at a financial plan and making it work within the parameters of that individual. Then they might go back to work part-time. We see that, you know, they might say, why, you know, people say to us, how much do I need to go and earn in order to make that work? Mm. And when we've known the numbers, we might say, well, you just go need to get a job at 10,000 a year. In 5 years' time, your plan will work. Oh, okay, that's fine.
It feels more doable when you break it down like that, doesn't it, than some sort of nefarious statement that says, oh, you've got to go back to work. And it's kind of like, well, what does that mean and how much and when? And yeah, so I can see it's such a sense of power, but also it just turns this notion of fair on its head, doesn't it? Because I think, you know, the question we get asked most probably is, what's fair? Is there a formula for fair? And, you know, as divorce coaches, we're always saying, no, there isn't a formula for fair. And there's going to be a negotiation. There's a range of what fair might look like, but it ultimately depends on individual circumstances. I think sometimes where the financial planning side of things is just worth its weight in gold is just working through whether what looks fair at the net effect schedule stage, which is the immediate division of the assets, whether that looks fair in 5, 10, 15 years. To me, that is the gold that the financial planning option offers. It's broadening the definition of fair. I don't know whether you see it in a similar way or you have a different answer when people say, what's fair?
What's fair? I think it's fair if it feels painful on both sides. It's probably about right.
Yeah.
You know, if one side is thinking, oh, it's brilliant, I got a really good deal there on my divorce, it's probably not right.
Yeah.
You know, both parties feel that pain and you see it and you feel it and you think, oh, it's a bit painful. I don't want to, you know, share my pension, but it is. And divorce is painful, you know, for lots of reasons. And, you know, and on kids as well, which is another conversation. But what's fair, if one of the parties has the lion's share of the childcare, then in my opinion, therefore, perhaps they should be awarded more than the 50% because they're going to have, you know, the roof over the head, the ongoing costs, and it all depends. And then getting back to earnings potential, if you have someone who's a real go-getter, an entrepreneur, you know, is going to have that earnings potential into the future and it's been a long marriage, then that might be another reason as to why there'd be an imbalance in the award. So with financial planning, what you can do is you can, as you say, Kate, you can look at the bottom line split, throw it into the future and think, oh, actually it looked fair on paper, but actually, you know, this person's going to have no retirement provision at all. And the other person's going to have £1 million in their pension fund. That doesn't seem really fair. So let's make a little bit of provision. Because even smaller amounts invested for the long term can become quite nice amounts, you know, over that period of time.
Yeah, yeah. And just sort of thinking about this as well. So one of the things that we often get asked as well is, do we have to split everything at the point of divorce? And I'm just wondering, are there any advantages to keeping things in joint names? I know the court's not keen on that, but from a financial planning perspective, is that something you come across ever?
The answer is no, we don't. However, just to caveat that, there are some occasions, of course, where people have to keep assets in common. Usually it's the property. It might be that they can't sell the house. They want to sell the house to split the proceeds, but just can't for whatever reason. And what we would do in that situation is do joint tenants in common. So you've got joint ownership, where a couple own a house jointly, or you can own actually physically half each, or 70-30 or 60-40, whatever your share of that house is. And therefore, they would have an interest in a joint asset, but they wouldn't own it jointly. Now, the upside of doing that is it's clear. The clear division is already there. Each individual will benefit from any uplift or down on the asset, so that's fair. Now, if you were to keep the asset joint, then there are risks with that. One of those is if there's a second divorce, it happens. The rate's higher in second marriage, the divorce rate. So that could be cited in another divorce, potentially, if you have a joint asset. The other thing is as well, let's go back to our example of the entrepreneur doing really well in business. He or she goes bust. They're going to come knocking on the door for their share in the matrimonial home, potentially. So it's a risk to tie yourself in with a jointly owned asset. And it's best to have that sort of clean break. And even to have a vested interest in a property still could be a potential problem with divorce, second divorce, and bankruptcy. So we don't very often see that. I haven't come across anyone who wanted to keep an actual joint ownership. Getting back to property, where there's a mortgage company involved, often they will want both parties to stay named on that property in order for that mortgage to be viable. Otherwise, they're going to struggle to keep that mortgage in situ. And again, we would suggest that they do the tenants in common instead of the joint assets to keep that going. And most lenders would accept that as long as they have an interest in that property.
Yeah, that's a very typical one, isn't it? Where one person wants to take the mortgage over, but the mortgage company won't release the other. We do get that quite a lot. And then we have to have what's called a Mesher style order with a trigger date for sale if you can't remove somebody at a later stage. So obviously, if you're a returning person to work, you can build up your income. You can get to a point where the mortgage company will allow you to take over that mortgage, then that's all well and good. But in the interim, it's very often the case that orders have to be written where the mortgage stays in situ.
Yeah, and it's not ideal, but if that's the way it has to be to keep the family home, especially where there's kids involved, then, you know, we do often come across that.
Yeah, cool. So, yeah, one of the other things I just wanted to ask about as well, Louise, was are there any special considerations when you've got children in terms of financial planning? So are there things that if you're divorcing, you should be thinking of when you've got kids over and above just splitting things between you and worrying about who's getting what?
Yeah, there's school fees, university fees, weddings, you know, try to agree what's going to happen before the whole thing's settled. So at least you know and there's no surprises. Children as well often have child trust funds and they have maybe little accounts or investments in their names. And these accounts are often held by one or the other of their parents. So that, you know, if it was me, for example, as a parent, I'd be holding that account on behalf of my sons. And they can stay in place because actually these accounts are designated to the children. They're really called bear trusts. They are the beneficiaries, but they're minors, so they can't have the money yet, not until they're 18. So those sorts of things can be kept, and it's quite nice because they can be added to as well. And these are the property of the child. Ultimately, it doesn't mean to say that the parents can't get their hands on it because they can. There lies the downside. But hopefully, it's unlikely that that would happen. And this is something that as a couple, you can agree that that can go towards, could be the first car. There's things like driving lessons, cars, car insurance, all of these things are massive expenses. So you could earmark, you know, the child trust fund, maybe it's a junior ISA or something like that, and say, actually, that's for the first car, or it's for university fees, or if they don't go to university, maybe it's towards a deposit on a house one day. Those sorts of things are really good to keep in place. And if you can start to, and it's really difficult because people often don't have any money when they're going through a divorce, but it's something that ultimately, as things settle, you can start to add to this, and both sides of the couple can pay into these accounts on behalf of the children.
Okay. I mean, we've been talking, haven't we, about it feels like quite amicable ways to sort this out. And I just wanted to clarify, as a financial planner, we work with couples as a divorce service. Do you work with couples as well? Or are you bound by the similar sort of rules that lawyers are, where you can only work with one?
We do work with couples on both sides. We have done. It's rare. It's rare, I suppose, because most divorces are not amicable, sadly.
Oh, we're trying to change that.
I know you're trying to change it, and I have great faith in the fact that you will. And if only people would listen, they'd save a heap load in legal fees if they would. Now, because we have a team here, then some couples are quite happy if, you know, say I could work with one party to the couple and one of my colleagues could work with the other. But it's very difficult. You almost have to build a Chinese wall. So what sometimes we do is we will have, you know, sort of the financial planning, which is not regulated advice, financial planning, the cash flow forecasting. I have sat with couples in the meeting room and discussed the financial plan with both of them. It's been really powerful. It's great to do that. And then one party may work with us and then the other party would go off and appoint their own financial planner. And really that's the best, because trying to build the Chinese wall inevitably is difficult.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, people listening to this who may be considering doing things more amicably, they could come into either our service or a mediation service. They could work on an agreement and then they could bring that agreement to you and you could run that to go back to this. Is it, it might look fair now, but is it fair in 10 years, 15 years? You could run that scenario for them because that's the part that's not regulated.
Absolutely. Could run that as a couple, have done it, and it has facilitated a good understanding for both parties. And then they can go away and make an informed decision and then speak to UK and the team and say, actually, these are our numbers. What do you think?
Yeah, we just need to tweak it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then talk it through. And then, you know, preferably, it's preferable for them to have their own financial planner or financial advisor to implement. Because, of course, there's pension sharing orders often. You know, at the minute, we've got quite a few of those going through very slowly at the minute, I have to add. It takes forever.
Just, doesn't it?
And then that's the other thing. Managing people's expectations on how long these things are going to take, especially when you're looking at defined benefit schemes. This is going back to getting your ducks in a row. You know, you have to get cash equivalent transfer values, and they do take up to 4 months to get the money across. That's they're supposed to work within the 4 month deadline, and it can do, and it does.
Yeah.
So it's managing expectations of people with regards to that.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I think sometimes people think once the divorce is done, that's it. But then you've got to implement your order, haven't you? So getting your consent order signed off by the court is only one part of it. Once that bit's done and effectively the amicable service ends, you then have to do the whole implementation work. And often it is with a financial planner to do the pension sharing, to set up a new pension for you, or to, you know, work out how you're going to invest a lump sum or all of those sorts of things. That's when the next phase of the work starts, isn't it? And you come into it even more.
And it takes time. And it should, really, because the decisions that you make going through a divorce, during the divorce, post the divorce, will set you up for your future. And it's important to make those right decisions. And that is to do with the products, the investments, who you work with. And I see people come to us and they've received a pension sharing order, or they might have received a capital lump of money and they want to invest it. Oh, I need to invest it. I need to get it sorted. But to slow down and make that decision, even if it takes 6 months, and you get that right and you structure it right, and it's tax efficient and it's for you, that's the best thing. That's the best thing to do. And you should critique the fees that you're paying. If anyone's opaque about their fees for their services, they're just not right for you. And there's plenty of them out there. Let me tell you, there's plenty of financial advice companies who are, oh, don't worry about the fees, it all comes out in the wash. No, how much are you paying? What are you getting for the service? What are they going to do? What's the ongoing service? And am I another number, or am I going to be looked after, not just now because you're going to be paid for me now, but are you going to look after me and plan for the future and the family and everything that goes on? Because life changes, doesn't it? So take time to really sort of rattle that around and make sure it is right for you.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to do a podcast soon all about financial abuse. So I don't want to spend ages just going through that. But just as we've talked, haven't we, about things being amicable and people doing things in the best interests of children and working together and trying to do as much of this themselves by doing their sort of homework. And what if that's just not possible? Just give us a little outline of the red flags to watch out for if this kind of approach isn't going to work for somebody.
Okay. if someone is the victim of financial or economic abuse, it's unlikely it's going to be an amicable divorce. Now, it's really shocking because one in four women and one in seven men suffer financial or economic abuse during their lives. So it's very likely that in our friendship or our, you know, colleagues or family, there is somebody right now who is suffering from this. Economic abuse is where person A restricts the ability of person B to gain the economic resources they need, such as food, shelter, or technology. For example, they might not have a phone. So that's a red flag, isn't it? Why haven't they got a phone? You know, why aren't they allowed to communicate? Or with financial abuse, which is people who don't have the money maybe that they should have or that they appear that they should have. So they might always shop in the sale and the husband drives a Porsche. You know, the clothes start to look a bit shabby. They have no say in where they go on holiday and no idea about the finances. Not joining in with outgoings with the girlfriends because, you know, the husband doesn't want them to or they can't afford it. You know, and working from home has exasperated this for people who are in those situations and they're in that environment all the time. And for me, it's as a financial planner, I'm going to go on the course and train to be a certified financial abuse expert because I think it's really important that we look for those signs because you can easily dismiss them and say, oh, that's just so-and-so. They always look a bit shabby. It might not be the case. And we really need to watch out for this, and especially because we're so privileged to be helping people through these changes in their lives through divorce. We need to watch out for it. And do you know what, Kate? I really don't think I have in the past, but now I'm aware. And if you feel that you're somebody who is in this position yourself, you need to have somebody working on your behalf with you to get you out of this situation. And if it is divorce, you want through it. So, for example, your coaches, your divorce coaches, Kate, and your team would certainly be a good start to make that phone call. Financial advisor, financial planner, it might be a difficult call to make, but at least say, tell somebody that you feel as though you're in this situation and reach out for some advice. But it really is up to the likes of us as I say, we're in these privileged situations that we find ourselves, Kate, to try and spot those people and earmark them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we would always say that if you're in that scenario, you need the individual protection of the court or a solicitor who's working in your best interest rather than trying to come into a negotiated service where we're working for the couple and we don't offer the individual protection that, say, a lawyer would. So in those scenarios, I'd always be at the ability to spot it. And I think it's really interesting, some of the examples you've just given there, Louise, about how you might spot financial abuse and it might not be what you're expecting. So I hadn't really thought about it in terms of the clothing and the things that you said. So I think if we do spot that, being able to signpost people to the appropriate place where they can get that one-to-one support and help, that's really critical and important.
And it's another podcast, Kate, but watch out for the Tinder swindler. Swindler and online dating is another podcast. But that's where people can, and especially wealthy individuals, be victims of financial abuse.
Yeah. Okay, well, just I think we're almost out of time, Louise, but I just wonder if there are people listening now and they're heading for a divorce and, you know, you've talked about financial planning, what are your just top tips? What would you say to them right at the outset of the process? What should they do to make sure they have a successful divorce?
Top tips, get a handle on your finances because you can make a really good start yourself and it's empowering, scary at first, but it's empowering and it'll save you fees. It'll save you fees whether you work with a divorce lawyer or going to amicable. Potentially it saves them time, saves you time, and you're in control. You put yourself in a position of strength by doing it. Don't just look at the now, look at the future. Stress test your plan. Visualize yourself in the future. What do you need? What don't you have that you might need? What about the kids? What about weddings? What about birthdays, big birthdays, 21st birthday parties? Who's going to pay for those? Cars. that sort of thing. Write it down. Know what your outgoings are and split them between essential and discretionary and nice to have. I think it's a good thing to do anyway, regardless of whether you're going through a divorce, especially now people are saying, how are we going to manage with this energy crisis? That's one of the things. I know it's dull. People don't want to do it. But if you know what your minimum is and you've got that, then it's reassuring to know that, and times will come back so that you can start with those discretionary expenditures again. Just know your numbers. Know your numbers. It puts you in a position of strength.
Brilliant. Listen, Louise, that was absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for all your help and advice today on the podcast. Where can people find out more about you?
Right, so they can go onto the Piercefield Oliver website, worldwideweb.piercefieldoliver.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, which is, for me, it's at Louise Oliver PO. That's Twitter. And my Insta is LouiseOliver5929. I do a lot of media. I'm on GB News regularly, so you might just catch me on the money slot there.
Brilliant. Well, like I say, it's been fabulous to talk to you. Thank you. You can also find out more about me. I'm at Kate_Daly. You can hear about new podcast episodes by following at divorce_podcast. And you can also subscribe to more of these podcasts if you've liked what you've heard today by visiting thedivorcepodcast.com. Thank you so much, Louise, for joining us. And thank you for listening too.
Thank you, Kate.